This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Neil Conan. President Obama addresses a joint session of Congress. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is back from her tour of Asia. Will it be three strikes and you're out for a new commerce nominee? And don't take this as an editorial comment, but they still haven't decided who won last November's Senate election in Minnesota, and the Minnesota state bird is the loon. I bring all that up because it's Wednesday, time for the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
NPR's political editor and political junkie Ken Rudin is here in the studio with me. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Joe.
That was good. And as usual, there's a lot to cover. The president's speech, the never-ending Senate race in Minnesota, the senator from Illinois is in trouble, so that could come up again. There are still cabinet seats to fill. The District of Columbia is getting closer to getting a vote in Congress. The House of Representatives.
I was going to say also this week, the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, is holding its annual conference, hence the term, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And it'll be interesting to listen to what conservatives have to say in the wake of a very popular Democratic president.
Absolutely. But first, you have our trivia question.
Okay, it's not a tough one. It's pretty easy. But given the fact all the attention on Roland Burris, of course, yesterday, Dick Durbin suggested basically that his fellow Illinois Democrat resign, and Roland Burris said he will not resign. But who were the last two senators who did resign because of ethics problems?
There were senators
to resign? There were.
My, my. Who were the last two senators who resigned because of ethics problems? If you think you know the answer, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Or send us an email with your answer and try and make it the right one. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Okay, so I think we have to first talk about last night, the speech that the president gave to a joint session of Congress and broadcast, of course, on all the networks and NPR. Did it work?
Well, you know something, if you listen to what everybody had to say about it, even what Republicans had to say about it, that the president, aside from, you know, earlier he'd been doing a lot of henny-penny, the sky is falling stuff, and I think the president felt that he has to underscore the severity of what's going on, but at the same time say that hope is on the way, recovery is in sight, and I think he accomplished both things. Polls show that he did. Polls show that among Democrats and, of course, and Republicans too, that he touched the right note. He, you know, there were some obvious jabs at his predecessor. Mm-hmm. There was one point when he mentioned that the problems we inherited, and of course the Democrats, you know, gave him a standing ovation for the problems we inherited. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, both Democrats and Republicans were constantly rising to their feet. If you watch Nancy Pelosi, she lost 15 pounds.
Yes.
She jumped up so many times.
It was more of an exercise regimen in these talks.
She was up there. But I think, both sides, seems like everybody agrees that the tones, the understanding that Barack Obama had for the situation was correct one.
Yeah. And the president, you know, said to thank you to Congress for passing his economic stimulus package. But at the same time, he said to the American people, look, I get your concerns about this stimulus package. And let's hear what he said.
But I also know that in a time of crisis, we cannot afford to govern. Out of anger or yield to the politics of the moment. My job, our job, is to solve the problem.
Right. So he's getting back to this concept of, you know, we can't be mad about the past. Yet, as you said, he did manage to put in a couple of jabs. Is this the dichotomy of the president?
I don't think so. I think from the beginning, though, there are a lot of Democrats who don't like this approach he's taken. But from the beginning, he has reached out to Republicans. We saw it with one trying to get Judd Gregg into his cabinet, two meeting with members of the House and Senate on the $787 billion economic stimulus package. But he did it again last night. Now, of course, it wasn't an official State of the Union message, and it doesn't really matter why, whether it was or not. I mean, the same tones, the same themes were out there, obviously, about the State of the Union. And obviously, the State of the Union is not that good. But Barack Obama clearly made it clear that he wanted Republican input as well as his own party.
Well, the response to the president came from the rising star of the Republican Party, Bobby Jindal, another man with an interesting background, and he gave the Republican response. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
On behalf of our leaders in Congress and my fellow Republican governors, I say this. Our party is determined to regain your trust. We will do so by standing up for the principles that we share, the principles you elected us to fight for, the principles that built this in the greatest, most prosperous country on earth.
So how did that work for you?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people, a lot of pundits and a lot of bloggers and a lot of people who spoke about it afterwards all reflected on what this means for 2012, and that's just nonsense. I don't know what's going to happen next week, let alone 2012, and to talk about that is just crazy. But I didn't get the feeling that Bobby Jindal, and like, you know, he's been talked about over and over again, a rising star, a possible future of the Republican Party. I don't think he did that well. He didn't seem that comfortable. Maybe he seemed too comfortable. But the urgency that we saw in Barack Obama, I didn't see it reflected in Bobby Jindal. But one thing I did notice, and I was thinking that this morning, here we have the first African-American as president. Sitting right behind him was the first Catholic vice president in history, the first female Speaker of the House in history. The Republican response was given by the first Indian-American governor in history. And today, Barack Obama named Gary Locke the first Chinese-American governor in history to serve as Commerce Secretary. A pretty interesting mix there.
Yeah, you're making me want to break into song. The times, they are a-changing. That's old, though, right?
Nor was it good.
No, okay, yeah. Sorry. I'll stop the singing, okay. I promise. Okay, at the speech last night, the members of the Supreme Court, they typically come to these things. It was a little bit of a surprise to see Ruth Bader Ginsburg walking in, looking a little frail but healthy. What about that?
Well, she had just undergone pancreatic cancer surgery. She, as you say, she looked frail, but of course, it was great to see her. We did not see Ted Kennedy, the senator from Massachusetts, who also was very ill, and we did not see him. But Barack Obama gave Justice Ginsburg a big hug, and it was just a good thing to see.
But Senator Jim Bunning, the Republican senator, he gave her a rather grim prognosis last week.
Well, that was kind of strange. Jim Bunning's been saying some very strange things over the last couple of years. But he did say last Saturday, it was a President's Day event, and he's quoted in the Louisville Courier-Journal as saying that Ginsburg had, quote, bad cancer, the kind you don't get better from, even though she was operated on usually 9 months is the longest that anybody would live with pancreatic cancer. Stirred up a whole bunch of hornet's nest. He apologized to Justice Ginsburg on Monday. Of course, in his statement, he misspelled her name. But it was just one of the latest embarrassment for Jim Bunning, who's up for re-election next year, barely won in 2004, and he's been raising very little money. There are five Republicans who have already announced their retirement. There are some Republicans who would love Jim Bunning to join that list because they feel that he may not survive the election in 2010.
Well, we're starting to get answers to your trivia questions, so let's take a call now from Myron in St. Paul, Minnesota. What's your answer?
Hi there. Let's try Bob Packard and John Tower.
Well, Bob Packard is one of the two. He did resign because he was under sexual harassment charges. He resigned from the Senate in 1995. John Tower should not be on the list. John Tower did not run for re-election in 1984. Then, of course, he was named nominated by the first President Bush to be Defense Secretary and was defeated. And he died. And he died in a plane crash. But he did not. He did not resign from the Senate. He served out a full term and retired in 1984. Okay. So we have one of the two.
One of the two. Okay, so Packwood is correct. Thanks very much for that call. Now we have an email here from Barbara who writes, Tom DeLay and Trent Lott.
Well, Trent Lott did resign, but not over ethics problems. Trent Lott did resign from the Senate to become a lobbyist, which sounded just as disheartening. And Tom DeLay did resign, perhaps because of ethics problems. But Tom DeLay was not in the Senate. He was the House Majority Leader when he resigned.
Okay. Well, Faye has two suggestions. Faye's in Minneapolis, and she wrote to us, Rostenkowski of Illinois and Durenberger of Minnesota.
Well, Durenberger was chastened by the Senate. He was, I don't know if he was censured or not, I can't remember, but he did serve out his term, didn't run for re-election, did not resign from the Senate. And, of course, Rostenkowski, who was not in the Senate, he was in the House, didn't resign. He was actually defeated for re-election in 1994.
He was chastened, but was he Sanborn?
Oh, God, that's grounds for divorce.
That's right.
Grounds, yeah. Okay.
Okay, we don't have, do we have any more answers, or do we want to, do we give out the answer now? We have one more. No, we still have more. This just in. Here's, we do have a, we have a winner.
Oh, wait, wait, so you're announcing the answer before you announce the winner? In other words, you're saying that he's the winner before he is?
Well, but
he
says on a piece of paper, it says, sorry.
Okay. And who is that person?
Greg in South Bend, Indiana, gives us the names of Robert Packwood, which, correct, if he was listening, he would have already gotten for free. But the other he suggests is Harrison Williams from New Jersey.
That's correct. 1982, Harrison Williams caught up in the app scam scandal. He resigned before the Senate was going to expel him. So the two answers are Bob Packwood and Harrison Williams.
Well, Greg from South Bend, Indiana, ding, 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 you are our winner this week. Very good.
And he gets the no prize.
The no prize.
Yes.
That's right. That was, well, though he did get the bell, so he got the no bell prize. Oh, I'm really sorry,
wow.
Ken.
Sounds
I'll
like
stop.
I'm, sounds like I'm sitting with Ken Rudin.
No, I'm trying to get ahead of you here, Ken. Okay, we only have a minute or so before the break. What about the Senate race in Minnesota, the Senate race from Minnesota? We've been talking about that each week, the Senate race in Minnesota.
No change except more and more judicial decisions seem to be going against Norm Coleman. But there are some Republicans who say, look, this could all go all the way to the Supreme Court. Democrats are hopeful that they can get Al Franken, the Democratic challenger, sworn in or confirmed, or bar mitzvah, either one, by March. But there are some Republicans who think that that's premature, that's optimistic, and the appeals may go beyond that.
Okay. And Roland Burris, Senator Roland Burris from Illinois, who's come under a cloud because of what he did or didn't know about Mr. Blagojevich's request for pay to play kind of thing.
And what he swore that was the truth, and then as it turned out that he had more involvement, Durbin told him to resign yesterday, suggested he resign. He said he would not, for it looks like we're going to have Roland Burris at least through the end of 2010.
Thank goodness. We're talking with Ken Rudin, our political junkie, and up next is the end taxation is it the end of taxation without representation for Washington, D.C.? We'll talk with Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton about the Senate move that could get her a vote in Congress. I hear that music. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Ken Rudin is with us, NPR's political editor. You can hear him every Wednesday as our political junkie and check out his blog anytime at npr.org. In a few minutes, what's next for conservatives? The Conservative Political Action Conference gets underway in Washington tomorrow. We want to hear from your conservative listeners, our conservative listeners. What do you, your conservative, anybody's conservative listeners, what do you think the conservative movement needs to do to regain its political clout? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, we have some big news for our little district here, the District of Columbia, that is. Yesterday, the Senate decided to consider a D.C. voting rights bill. Right now, residents of the district have a delegate in the House of Representatives, and we're hoping to be talking with her in a moment. But first of all, Ken, what's the deal with the D.C. Voting Rights Act? Is that, that's what it's called, right?
Well, here's what happened. Yesterday, the Senate voted 62-34 to begin the debate on giving the District of Columbia a full voting rights member of Congress in the House. Right now, Eleanor Holmes Norton, a Democrat first elected in 1990, is a delegate. Now, she's not a congresswoman. She could vote in committee. She could not vote on the full floor. The Senate, and the House is probably going to pass it this week. The Senate will take it up, perhaps this week as well. And that is to give D.C. a voting rights, a voting delegate in the House, and also give Utah a fourth member of the House, so basically to assuage.
Very French of you, yes.
Both the Democratic and Republican new member of Congress, they would expand the House from 435 to 437 members.
Well, we have Eleanor Holmes Norton on the line from her office on Capitol Hill. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Hello.
So,
and by the way, she can't be, she is a member of Congress. She is a congresswoman. She is not a, quote, representative. Only when you have the vote.
I see.
You'd be called a representative.
I see. So would this bill change that?
It would, because it would mean that for the first time in two centuries, the District of Columbia, the nation's capital, pay taxes, go to war like everybody else, would have a vote like everybody else.
So how big an achievement, how big a step is this vote in the Senate?
The vote in the Senate is a huge step because the Senate stopped this last time. And this time, the majority leader and the committee chair, Mr. Lieberman, were so confident that they have gone ahead of the House. As I speak, the House is marking up the bill here. And I like to think of this as a race to the finish line. Who will get there first, the Senate or the House? Last time it was the House, and then we had to wait for the Senate. Said 51% is not a majority there, unlike every other place on the planet. And that we had 57%. We did not prevail there. This time we have passed the greatest hurdle. Usually, if you, in fact, defeat a filibuster on whether you should proceed at all and debate, you have, in fact, prevailed. There will be amendments, and they will be nasty ones.
Mm-hmm.
But those are usually by 51%.
I see. Ken?
Congresswoman Delegate, Ms. Norton, two things. First of all, you mentioned that once you pass the filibuster-proof 60 vote in the Senate, it's a big hurdle. But, of course, some members like Lisa Murkowski said that she voted for it just to have the debate, but she's going to vote against the final version. But you also mentioned that the House and Senate vote were the finish line. A lot of people think that the finish line is really in the courts.
Yeah, well, so what? So that's the finish line for most legislation we pass here. I'm grateful that Senator Murkowski at least had, seems to me, the spirit of American freedom and liberty to not want to shut off debate on something as important as voting rights. And if she's not going to vote for us, all I can say is I don't think we'll need her. We had two Democrats who were not there, and that would have made, 65 right there. If we have another filibuster, and that is not impossible, there could be a filibuster of the bill, then we would have a closer vote. But that's why we wanted and got a comfortable margin.
You know that every time Robert Byrd is quoted, like when he's talked about the war, they say, well, he's a great constitutional scholar. Robert Byrd says that this is not a constitutional measure.
Yeah, and I suppose of all of the people who claim constitutionality as the reason for not voting, he's the only one I would credit. There's a saying in the House and the Senate that when a member gets up to say that he opposes a bill on constitutional grounds, you know he was against it all along, and he was using that. He's using that because he can't find any reason anybody would respect. Well, Senator Byrd lives in, I'm afraid, the Constitution of yesterday. I don't believe he's taken a serious look at the District of Columbia or at how the courts have looked at the District of Columbia. For example, I wonder if he knows that every time that, and there may be a half dozen times in which people have gone to court and it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has treated the district as a state, even though the Constitution only says that the, quote, states can do this, that, or the other. Each and every time the Supreme Court has said, oh, wait, go away from here. For these purposes, the district is to be treated as a state, whether it's a diversity jurisdiction, and there are four or five other ways in which only states are mentioned in the Constitution. But my favorite one is the 16th Amendment that says that residents of the states shall pay federal income taxes. If we want to go about, for the first time, literally drawing the word state that way, let's start with the 16th Amendment. We got a lot of back pay coming.
Right. That would mean changing all the license plates for no taxation with no representation.
Exactly, among other things. We'd rather have the money back.
Right, exactly. That's probably better. Well, Eleanor Holmes, Norton, thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate it. Good luck. Eleanor Holmes Norton is the District of Columbia's delegate to the House of Representatives. Okay, from D.C. statehood, we move on to the conservative political activist group called CPAC. Each year they meet and discuss the future. This year's meeting starts tomorrow. And conservatives have a lot of challenges. What do you think lies ahead for the conservative movement? We especially want to hear from our conservative listeners. What do you think the conservative movement needs to do to regain its political clout? Call us at 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK, and the email is talk@npr.org. And my guest for our discussion is David Keene. He's chairman of the American Conservative Union, a conservative lobbying organization, and he's a sponsor of the annual CPAC convention. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what is at the top of the CPAC agenda in this meeting coming up?
Well, I think this year, and this is going to be the largest conservative political action conference in the history of the of these gatherings. The first one was held in 1973, and the principal speaker that year was Ronald Reagan. I think 100 or 125 people were in attendance to hear him. Last year, about 7,000 people attended, and this year it appears that there will be 8,500 to 9,000 attendees here in Washington at this conference. The number of people that are turning out and the enthusiasm of the response this year is in itself a bit of a rebuttal to those who argue that the conservative movement is dead. In fact, these are people who are coming to talk about ideas and policies, to see potential candidates and leaders, and to figure out how they can best proceed in the years that are the years ahead. So it's going to be exciting in that sense. And I think if I were to address your question of what is their major interest, or what is it that they're looking to do this year, there's a debate going on, most of it led, frankly, by critics of conservatives who say that if you want to survive and remain relevant after the 2008 election, you really ought to change. There are those who are suggesting that the concept of limited government was a concept for another day, we ought to abandon a belief in free markets, that we ought to move in and become a managerial party of the Republicans and conservatives, and that we should just get off these principles that have sustained us for so long. We've heard this in the past. We had the same arguments after the 1964 election, after 1974 when the Nixon crew had bollocks things up with Watergate, and we're having it again this time. Our message is very clear. Republicans lost because of their performance, not because of conservative values and ideas. And that was illustrated both by the Obama campaign, where he recognized the nature of the Republican electorate, and by exit polls. So what we're trying to make clear to Republicans, if they want conservative support, and indeed if they want to win elections, they need to stand by principle. They don't need to run off, but to get their own act together, to present alternatives to liberal proposals, and to do so articulately. This is the second time that our conference is being keynoted by Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, who is probably one of the brightest members of the House of Representatives, and who has spent his career developing free market conservative alternatives to many of the things that ultimately now are being voiced by the Democratic administration.
Well, let's take a call now and see what our listeners have to say about this this situation facing conservatives, and go to Michael in New Orleans. Michael, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. How y'all doing?
We're good.
Well, sir, first I wanted to say that I agreed with your last statement that we need to really return to the core issues, and that was my sheer point, that we need a government that encourages small business, that encourages tax benefits to us, the people that are out there sweating for it and really working hard. And second, I think that the conservative movement in the United States needs to trim a lot of the fat that distracts from the major issues. And I believe that the abortion issue, a lot of the religious right issues, that those things really don't, they take away from the true core of conservatism, which is financial.
Okay, Michael, thanks for that. Ken Rudin, do you think David Keene is right? The message is sound, but the performance was lacking?
Well, David has been saying this a long time, that, fighting for limited government is the philosophy, but you could also make the argument that limited government was not the Bush administration philosophy in the last 8 years, and a lot of these conservatives who are now talking critical of the Obama spending programs, the Obama administration spending programs, were probably much more quiet during the last 8 years. David, would you agree, though, that it's much easier to go on the offensive against Obama than be defensive over a Bush administration?
Well, I think Ken, your analysis is not incorrect, but it illustrates a couple of things. First of all, the sort of unfortunate identification of conservatives with whoever the Republican office holder or candidate is. When you've got a president of either party in power, his elected officials and some others who sort of sign on as loyalists, go along with things even when they know they're wrong. Conservatives on the spending issues in particular were far too quiet in the early days of the Bush administration. And indeed, it was another issue that really got their dander up and made them draw the line, and that was, as you'll recall, the Harriet Myers Supreme Court nomination, where finally conservatives stood up and said, that's it, we're not going to accept this, it was withdrawn, and we got somebody better. In the last year or so of the Bush administration, before the economic crisis, where he sort of went AWOL, the criticism of spending, which had reached a crescendo just before the 76 election within the Republican Party, finally got the Bush administration's attention. And he did start to make some effort to cut back. But you're right, and that is that with him in power, a lot of people sort of signed on. Well, they didn't sign on, they didn't agree, but they went along with it. And that's always the case when you get these things. But what's important is to stand up even against your own people, even against people that you identify as friends or candidates that you see as your friends. I remember, Ken, a lot of your listeners being young people wouldn't, but I remember in 1972 when John Ashbrook, a previous chairman of the American Conservative Union, then a congressman from Ohio, announced that he was going to run in the 72 primaries against Richard Nixon.
No left turn.
Mm-hmm. And I talked to John at the time. He was a good friend. I said, why are you doing this? Because you're not going to get more than 8 or 9 or 10% of the vote. I think he got 9 in New Hampshire.
David, I'm going to ask you to hold for one moment and remind people that they're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So let's take another call now and go to Janae in Mesa, Arizona. Janae, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to agree with your guest, David Keene, that the Republican Party does need to hold true to its values and its principles, and that is how it will be strong. And I also wanted to disagree with one of the statements made by your previous callers who said that the heart of conservatism is financial. I do identify as somewhat a financial conservative, but I think issues like abortion and like traditional family are very important. That's largely why I vote conservative, and I think we need to hold true to those values, too. I don't think they're irrelevant at all.
What about that, David King?
First, let me finish what I said before. I asked John about that, and he said, sometimes you want to be able to say you weren't there. And not enough of us, when the Bush administration went off track, were able to say we weren't there. But it was important, and it's always important that you do. Your caller makes a very good point that the conservative movement's political success, and indeed the makeup of the conservative coalition, if you will, consists of three groups: national defense conservatives, economic conservatives, and social conservatives. Those groups have always had some tension, but they've always stuck together, and they've been the basis of conservative strength. And without any one of them, the conservative movement is much weaker than it would otherwise be.
So I'm curious, just apropos of some of your earlier comments, who would you identify as the last real conservative president in the United States?
I think that most conservatives look to Ronald Reagan as the last real conservative president. If you talk to a young person today and said, here's what a conservative president would be like, and described Ronald Reagan's policies, they wouldn't recognize that as the conservatism identified with George Bush's policies, because they were so very different. Now, that doesn't mean that Ronald Reagan changed the world overnight, but it means that he went in there and he pursued policies that conservatives applauded, not just applauded because he was president, but because he came out of the movement. You know, we talked earlier about the fact that we have CPAC. He spoke at 17 of these conferences as governor, private citizen, and president. When he went into the White House, he went in as a committed, thinking, educated conservative.
All right. Well, David Keene, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
David Keene is chairman of the American Conservative Union. He joined us by phone from his office in Washington. And we'll hang on to our political junkie, Ken Rudin, a bit longer. Up next, the language of crisis. Did President Obama live up to the examples of Reagan, Roosevelt, and Kennedy? I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.